ronde. Michael Moorcock, je suis sûr que vous en avez quasiment tous au moins lu un, si ce n'est plusieurs, parce que Michael Moorcock, c'est évidemment des cycles comme Elric, dont on se souvient, mais aussi Hawkmoon, mais aussi Erecozé, et puis Jerry Cornelius, et puis tout un tas d'héros comme ça. J'ai dit Corum, oui, j'ai dit Corum. Hawkmoon aussi, enfin bon. Les danseurs de la fin des temps, et plus proche de nous, Mother London. Donc voilà, on va essayer de parler un petit peu de tout ça. Michael Moorcock est né en 1939. Peut-être une première question. On va revenir au tout début. Je crois que votre premier magazine, c'était à l'âge de 9 ans. Quels étaient vos héros à ce moment-là?
Pretty much the same ones as they are now. Edgar Rice Burroughs, T.H. White, and then just familiar people like Charles Dickens and George Bernard Shaw, which was very strange for a 9-year-old, but I started reading him very young, anyway.
Et à partir de quel moment vous avez commencé à écrire, à vouloir raconter des histoires?
Really, around the same time. I mean, when I was—I can't remember a time when I didn't want to do it. I was expelled from my boarding school for telling stories. I used to tell them at night to the other children, and eventually that was only one of the reasons I was expelled. But I was finally asked. My mother was asked to remove me from the school. So. I've been doing it pretty much all my life with mixed reactions.
Peut-être une petite question. Je crois qu'Elric, j'ai lu que c'était à partir de 17 ans que vous l'avez écrit, très jeune. Vous vous souvenez des débuts d'Elric?
I'd already done a series of stories for Tarzan Adventures, which I was editing by then, and I was working with an artist called Jim Cawthorne, and Jim and I just began talking about a new character that I wanted to write about, and Jim began doing drawings of Elric, and then I would give him some more material, and he'd do some more drawings, and then we forgot about it for. I suppose about 3 years, and eventually I was then asked by an editor, by Ted Carnell, the editor of Science Fantasy, if I would do a series, or rather one story originally for the magazine, and I had these ideas, and I made, you know, I made them into a proper story, and that was how it began.
Dès le début, il était comme nous le connaissons, albinos, avec une épée qui s'appelle Stormbringer, avec une grande faiblesse. Dès le début, vous aviez imaginé déjà toute la synthèse, ou est-ce qu'il a évolué au fil du temps?
Yes, I did. I admittedly stole the character from there was a detective series which I'd read as a boy. And there was a great villain in the series called Zenith the Albino, and he was rather similar to Elric. And it was an homage. I mean, I really did. I still like Zenith. I wrote a Zenith story this year, so I do. I think it was fairly legitimate, but that's how he started. Yes.
Elric, c'est le personnage que l'on vous associe tout de suite. Hein, on dit Michael Moorcock, Elric. Quel est votre regard, vous, sur Elric? Vous n'en avez pas marre qu'on vous en parle un peu tout le temps?
Well, people do, and I don't mind. I mean, I'm very fond of Elric. He's kept me in luxury for many years. So I don't feel the way that some people feel about their popular characters. You know, Conan Doyle was supposed to hate Sherlock Holmes, And this has been true of a number of people who've had very successful characters. But I still like him, and I still write stories about him. I've done in fairly recently. I did a series in comics of new stories in comics in the States, and I'm doing a series. And of course, I wrote the new one with Fabrice Collin here, which was only published in France, and I'm still writing. Still writing Ulrich stories. I can't seem to stop.
On discutait tout à l'heure avec Nancy Kress sur les personnages et leur écrivain. Est-ce que pour vous, c'est plus qu'un personnage de papier? Est-ce qu'il est vivant quelque part?
Oh yes, of course. I never reread the stories. I never had to reread them. I seem to know enough, at any rate, of the previous stories, well enough. So yes, I must. You know, he must be real to me. Or I couldn't write them in that way. But I think that's true. Pretty much every author I know, if they have characters that they identify with, they're just going to carry on with that particular identification. I don't think you lose it ever.
Il y a eu quelque chose d'assez incroyable en France, c'est effectivement un nouveau roman sur Elric qui est sorti il y a 2 ans avec Fabrice Collin. Comment est née cette aventure et parlez-nous peut-être de, est-ce qu'il y a une relation particulière entre la France et Michael Moorcock?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was the first professional comic with Elric in it was done by Philippe Druyer, and he did them, I think, in 64, 65, something like that, very soon after they'd started to appear in book form. And so I've always had a very close relationship with France and Elric. It just always has been like that. So it wasn't a particularly novel thing to me to do. It was just natural to do it. And I talked about it with Fabrice for maybe 2 years before we actually wrote it. And then I wrote half of it, and Fabrice wrote the other half, and the rest is history. I always have. There's a new comic coming out next year, which is all original from France too. So I live here part of the year. So I've got every reason to want to do new Elric stories for France.
On a parlé du roman, vous avez évoqué le comics, et puis il y a le serpent de mer, il y a le film d'Elric. Où est-ce que ça en est très précisément?
The sea serpent?
The movie.
No, I'm not aware of a movie. Actually, there's been movies prepared, but there's no movie about to come out at the moment that I know of. Versions of Elric have turned up in movies, but not actually Elric. So there's nothing. There are people who are talking about doing Elric, either in anime form or in live action form, but so far nothing's happened. I mean, they come and go. You know, it's a very expensive thing to do, and also Hollywood, where the money has to come from, they're always very wary of a character like Elric. He's too dark for most Hollywood people. But eventually, I think he will. Again, we've been talking about doing an Elric movie that originates in France rather than originates in America. So we'll have to see. One of the guys who wants to do an Elric movie works with a French producer, All his previous films have been done with a French producer. He's English, but his producer is French. And we've been talking about doing that too. But so far, nothing concrete has developed.
Elric, on l'a dit, vous l'avez commencé donc très tôt, et puis sont venus après d'autres héros. À partir de quand le concept du champion éternel et du multivers est né dans votre esprit? Quand est-ce que le concept du multivers et du champion éternel est né pour vous?
Very early on, again when I was 17, I wrote the beginnings of a story called The Eternal Champion, but in a fanzine. But the fanzine only lasted one issue, so there was only one very short piece. And then I wrote a long novella for the same magazine that Elric was appearing in, I think, 1961, 62. The first Eternal Champion ideas were published in that year, and also the first multiverse ideas were published at the same time, in the same year. So I had the ideas pretty much together. Sorry.
Peut-être une petite question, alors toujours sur Elric, mais sur l'ensemble de votre œuvre, la relation à la musique. Alors notamment sur Elric, on se souvient d'une chanson de Deep Purple qui s'appelait Stormbringer. Est-ce que vous savez comment votre œuvre a influencé quelques musiciens et quels sont les allers-retours?
Yes, I mean. I always was a musician as well as a writer, so I was playing in my first bands when I was 15, 16. We had a skiffle group which performed around London, and so I've always been doing music at the same time as I've written fiction. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the rest. I'm sorry.
Simplement, Elric, alors je pense notamment à cette chanson qui s'appelle Stormbringer de Deep Purple. Comment ça s'est fait?
Oh, Deep Purple, that they ripped that off straight. I mean, they just picked the name. There were two. A guy called John Martin also had an album called Stormbringer. And they just liked the name. They didn't know anything about the stories at all. I can't remember which guy it was, but one of the guys in Deep Purple was interviewed in New Musical Express, and the interviewer said, why did you take the name Stormbringer from Michael Moorcock? And he said, I didn't. He said, it's a name in mythology. And the interviewer said, no, it isn't. And the guy from Deep Purple said, yes, it is. And he said, no, it isn't. And that sort of went on like that. And finally he gave up. I had no relation with Deep Purple at all. In fact, I didn't like them very much as a band. But I did work with other musicians. I mean, the main one being Hawkwind, which I did a lot of work with. I mean, I performed with them and wrote for them, and also Blue Oyster Cult was another band that I worked with, and I did Elric's songs for both those bands, and performed them with both those bands, and I've worked with other musicians in the past. I'm still working now. I mean, I'm doing a new album at the moment with some friends. But that's not an Elric album. It does derive from another series of books, but much later books, which haven't been published in France. It's called Live from the Terminal Cafe. But that's an ongoing project that I'm doing just now. And I had to give up playing the guitar because my fingers don't work anymore. So I'm now playing the harmonica, which is the only instrument I seem to be able to play these days.
Je voulais faire un petit bond dans le temps parce que Norman Spinrad était avec nous hier et on a parlé évidemment de la période Newsworld, hein, ce magazine que vous avez dirigé pendant 4 ans, 5 ans.
A lot longer than that. But anyway, go on. Anyway, go on.
et donc, on dit souvent que vous avez fait éclore toute une génération d'écrivains. On parle de Zelazny, de Spinrad, de Brunner, de John Wolfe. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous décrire un peu l'ambiance de l'époque et comment vous avez découvert ces quatre noms notamment?
Well, it was a particular period. I mean, I took over New Worlds in 1964. The atmosphere of the time, the cultural atmosphere of the time was one of considerable experiment, there were a group of us that sort of came out of science fiction or were attracted to science fiction. We felt at the time that modernist literature had pretty much reached a dead end and wasn't producing anything of any great interest. So we thought that from science fiction we could take a new kind of fiction that wasn't specifically science fiction, but it wasn't normal realist literature either. And in a way it prefigured the magic realist movement that came later. And I just was looking for authors that were working in a certain way, that were addressing contemporary issues, both in language and in subject matter. And originally it was me, J.G. Ballard, and a writer called Barry Bailey, who's the sort of unknown member of that trio, but a very, very good writer. And when I was asked to become editor of New Worlds by the previous editor, I agreed to do it, but only if I could do something different, something new. I didn't want to just produce the same sort of fiction that had been produced up until then, because we were very frustrated. We had nowhere to publish, really. So I began publishing. It's true I published Zelazny early, but I wasn't the first to publish Zelazny. Zelazny had published in America, a few stories in America before he published in England. Spinrad, of course, Thomas M. Dish, John Sladek, a whole bunch of writers who were all of them very, very literate. They were very, very familiar with modern literature, but they all felt that they could write a better kind of fiction by using some of the tropes of science fiction. So in that sense it was called the new wave, and there were two new waves. One was American and one was English, and the English one essentially was writers, general writers, who were attracted to science fiction as a way of expressing what they had to say. Whereas in America, it was usually science fiction writers who felt that science fiction could be improved, could be given, could be made more respectable. And we weren't interested in being respectable. In fact, most of the work we published was experimental in one way or another. Spinrad being a good case in point. And so I made the magazine available to writers who were writing in that tradition, but as it was as much an absurdist tradition as it was a science fiction tradition. I mean, I was as much influenced by a writer called Ronald Furbank, who's an absurdist writer, Boris Vian, people of that kind, Alfred Jarry. I mean, a whole bunch of sort of offbeat writers. But that's how we started, and we ran more than 4 or 5 years. We ran from 64 until 71. Then there was a break, and then we ran again from 72 in a different format until I think about 75, and then we ran from 77 to 79, I think. We've had other issues since then, but we stopped running as a regular monthly. We finally stopped running as a magazine as such in I think about 79. But there've been other manifestations of the magazine. Still are. I mean, we're still. There's one actually running now. I haven't seen it, but it's being published in England. But I've yet to see it, so I don't know what it's like.
Ça a été aussi une période d'intense production littéraire pour vous, énormément de romans, souvent aussi pour financièrement aider le magazine.
Yes, yeah. And me. I mean, I supported myself as well as the magazine. That's the time when I learned to write a novel in 3 days. I mean, I didn't have any longer than 3 days. I could only spare 3 days to write the novels, so I wrote them very quickly. They were establishing a certain convention, and they were fairly easy to write. I read a lot of novels. I can't expand on that, really.
C'est aussi une époque où on voit apparaître les autres héros qui vont marquer des générations de lecteurs. Vous avez fait plusieurs héros qui vraiment ont marqué. Il y a eu Elric, mais il y a aussi Corum, Eric Ozé, Hawkmoon. Est-ce que vous vous souvenez un petit peu comment ces héros sont nés dans votre imagination? Quel est le point de départ où vous vous disiez, tiens, là, je tiens un héros particulier et je vais en faire plusieurs histoires?
It's hard to remember because it's like the 60s altogether. If you can remember them, you probably weren't there. And I do feel much the same about those books because I wrote them in such a white heat of production that it's very hard to remember details of them. Again, they were just my attempt to bring something new to fantasy. I mean, but only because, not because I didn't have any specific reason for wanting them to be new, but I get bored very easily, and when I get bored, I have to do something new, and that's the reason I was writing them then, but I don't remember much about them at all. I haven't read them any. I didn't read any of them. I still haven't. I mean, I actually have not read a single fantasy novel as such that I wrote. I just have to try to remember them. But if readers ask me a specific question, I can't answer it. I'm sorry.
Parmi vos héros, il y en a un, alors pas tout à fait en fantasy, mais c'est Jerry Cornelius qui a une place un petit peu à part.
I wanted to write a new kind of fiction, and using using what I'd learned from pulp fiction and from generic fiction, but I wanted it to. I just wanted it to relate to my own experience, and the experience of my generation, and that was a rock and roll generation. And where I lived was in Ladbroke Grove in London, and Ladbroke Grove was where most of the sort of the rock and roll people lived, as well as a lot of poets and artists. It was a bohemian area, a bit like it's very similar, in fact, to Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. Just a lot of people came to the same neighborhood at the same time. And I said, if you didn't play a fretted instrument at that time, you were thought to be rather strange, because pretty much everybody did. For instance, I mean, the movie Performance was made in that neighborhood. Jimi Hendrix died about two doors from where I lived. And everybody knew everybody. So a lot of artists and writers, we all knew one another. And out of that came a lot of experiment. And so Cornelius was an experiment. I wanted a character that would actually carry a lot of ideas that, or rather would deal with ideas without recourse to the normal techniques of realist fiction, but at the same time didn't have very much to do with science fiction. At that time, science fiction had to be rational. It had to be rationalized in some way. And Cornelius was not rationalized. I mean, there was no rationale. You had to guess at what was going on. And in a way, it was like writing a kind of fiction that somebody in the future might understand better than somebody in the present at that time, which may be why he's lasted as long as he has. But yeah, I mean, that was Jerry. And of course, I still write. It's as much a technique as it is a character, and it's a way of addressing, if you like, the news as the news comes at you. It's and so I wanted to develop a way of writing in fiction what you could do. I'm a journalist. I mean, so I wrote nonfiction as well. But I wanted to be able to write something that would deal immediately with modern issues, with contemporary, with the moment. So that's really why I developed him, and still use him. I still like him. I like all of my characters, really. Which is unusual. Sorry.
Est-ce qu'on peut dire que c'est vraiment quasiment votre personnage presque le plus fou, si on peut l'appeler comme ça?
Well, when they were making a movie, they made a Jerry Cornelius movie in the 70s. The part was offered to Mick Jagger, and Mick Jagger turned it down because he said Jerry Cornelius was too freaky. So it'll give you some idea what how people saw him. I didn't, of course, think he was freaky at all. I thought he was very normal, but that was the life I was leading. I've always thought of Mick Jagger as a bit of a fake in that for that reason. Yeah, I mean that was it.
Jerry Cornelius va un petit peu partout, mais il va notamment à Londres. Vous en avez beaucoup parlé. Quelle est votre relation à Londres et aux grandes villes? On se souvient de votre ville mythique, hein, Talleyrand.
Well, again, when I was young, I really wanted to write about London because that's my home city. I wanted to find a way of writing about London as a myth, if you like, or to see it as a myth, to deal with urban mythology. And So that was how I developed the character. And yes, it was very close. I mean, I do have a very close relationship with big cities. A few years ago, I moved to a small town outside of Austin in Texas, and I immediately became ill because I had no way of dealing with rural air. And I really did. I developed an autoimmune disease precisely because my immune system was so good because I was used to living in a big city and right in the middle of some of the most dense urban terrain. So that when I did move to the country, I breathed this so-called good air. I immediately became ill, and really was ill for some years as a result of it. It was the biggest mistake I ever made, was to move away from the city, which is why I live in Paris now, a good deal of the time.
Autant dire qu'on a de la chance en France. On va parler de l'actualité relativement proche. On a parlé de Fabrice Colin et de ce nouvel Elric il y a un ou deux ans. On parle aussi du Docteur Who. Vous avez écrit un roman pour le Docteur Who. Comment ça s'est fait?
Oh yeah, I did. I love Doctor Who. Almost all Doctor Who. I particularly like the Tom Baker Doctor Who and the current ones. The new series, the three new most recent Doctor Who's I like too. When the BBC asked me to write a novel, I jumped at the chance because I'd included Doctor Who in a couple of Jerry Cornelius novels just as a sort of walk-on part. I'd never obviously written, they wouldn't let me write about him just like that. So when they asked me to do a Doctor Who, I thought this was a chance to essentially bring Doctor Who into my multiverse and introduce him to Jerry Cornelius and so on. And that's why I did it. I mean, it was just nice to be able to write something like that as a sort of homage from my own enthusiasm. So that's why I did it. I also rewrote. It's my first multiverse book. Was a book called The Sundered Worlds, which I wrote in, I think, 61, 62, and I essentially rewrote that book, which was a very bad book. I mean, really bad. And so I rewrote it as a Doctor Who novel and tried to make it a much better book the second time around.
Quand on lit un petit peu vos livres, hein, quand on se balade un petit peu à travers tous les cycles, on se rend compte qu'il y a une grande, grande liberté. Est-ce que c'est pour ça que vous avez choisi la science-fiction et la fantasy, pour la liberté d'imagination que ça vous donnait?
The freedom was, at the time, was like rock and roll. My generation particularly had two enthusiasms. One was science fiction and the other was rock and roll. And pretty much everybody in English rock and roll read science fiction. That's not true of the other way around. I mean, there are very few people in science fiction were interested in rock and roll at that time. But the reason I was attracted to it was because it's very similar to the way things are with games, for instance. In a later generation, it was something that the adults didn't know anything about and thought was suspicious of it. You know, they thought there's something not quite right about this, and they didn't quite know what was wrong, but they knew there was something wrong with particularly rock and roll, but also science fiction. There was no body of criticism either for rock and roll or for science fiction at that time. I mean, there were a few people who wrote about it, but there were no magazines devoted to criticism, no academics interested in it. And it meant that you could do it without getting self-conscious. It was a way of avoiding becoming self-conscious about what you wrote, because you made it your own. It was your own. As a teenager, you know, it was something you could identify with, and adults, as it were, an older generation, despised it, which was good, because, you know, that was exactly how you wanted it, you know. But that was the reason, without any doubt. That I think if I was young now, I probably wouldn't be as attracted to what was going on now. Precisely because there now is a large body of academic criticism in both areas, and I think that would probably make me look somewhere else for a different kind of inspiration. I don't know what it would be, but that was the reason anyway.
Vous avez longtemps observé la science-fiction, la fantasy, les nouveaux auteurs, etc. Alors, sans dire c'était mieux avant, est-ce que vous avez l'impression que c'est toujours le même bouillonnement par rapport à ces années 60?
No. In a word. it's become there, it's the reason. The reason we rejected science fiction, I mean, this is a point I should have made earlier. We did reject the science fiction that was available to us, most of what was available to us. And the reason was that it had an element of nostalgia within it, a looking backwards rather than a looking forwards. I mean, it was they were forever destroying the planet in order to make the planet more simple, and so on. And I know there are people, there are good people making, you know, writing very good stuff now. I mean, I like them. I mean, I'm not trying to dismiss the whole field. But once something becomes established as a genre or a series of genres, I mean, science fiction isn't really one genre, it's 10, 20 genres. It's the same with rock and roll. It becomes... You know how it's going to turn out. In the old days with rock and roll, if you went into the studio, you didn't know what you were going to come out with. You'd go in and, you know, you'd hope for the best. But there weren't engineers. There were very few engineers who could. You knew how they were going to produce. They didn't know how they were going to produce it. You didn't know what you were going to do. And it was the same with science fiction in those days, that the kind of science fiction we were producing, because it was new, we didn't really have any established ideas about it. And that is what I liked about it. What I don't like about it now is that too often... if I pick up a book, if somebody sends me a book to review, I've already read it, or I know where it's going to go, and so I don't have the same. I must admit, I mean, I don't have. This isn't to dismiss it, because it still works, and it clearly works because there are a lot of people that it works for. So, you know, that's indisputable. But for me, it doesn't have the same attraction. I just can't get as excited about it as I did in 1960. I mean, it's just the way things are, you know. I'd probably be more interested in games, specifically games now, and doing electronic games in particular now. In fact, what I'm trying to do now is to do, if you like, mixed media work. When I did the final program, which is the first Jerry Cornelius novel, I produced it with a tape a cassette tape, pictures. I wanted the whole thing to be done as an early form of mixed media, but the publishers said there was no way of doing it. There's no way of selling it. There were different taxes on music and on books. So the retailers didn't know how to deal with it. Nobody knew how to do it. So eventually the book just came out with a few pictures in it. And I've done a lot of Cornelius music. I did with Hawkwind, I did with my own band, The Deep Fix. We used Cornelius a lot. And I've forgotten what the hell I was saying. I'm a very old, senile old man. That's the problem. Oh yes, with Cornelius. And now you can do it. With electronics and with computers, you can put something together that's both a novel. It can have spoken word in it. It can have animation in it. There are lots of things you can do with it. And I'm currently talking to publishers, trying to persuade publishers to, or not even publishers as such in the conventional sense, but somebody, because I don't have the skills to put it all together myself, to produce something that I was trying to produce in 1965, but I couldn't. Now I can. I mean, now I have a lot of music that can go with the Cornelius stories. I can do new Cornelius stories. I can relate them to contemporary issues, songs that relate to the contemporary world, and so on. So that's what I find really exciting now. I think probably if I was 20. I was 20 in 1960. If I was 20 now, I'd be working with a computer entirely. I wouldn't even be thinking of writing novels, you know.
Il nous reste une dizaine de minutes. Le temps file. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question à poser à Michael Moorcock? Allez, c'est le moment. Monsieur devant, qui lève la main. Le micro arrive.
Bonsoir. Je voulais savoir comment vous était venue l'idée du cycle des danseurs de la fin des temps, cette espèce d'avenir où les gens reviennent à des temps passés. Il y a des comportements un petit peu excessifs. Est-ce que c'est une critique de la société actuelle ou est-ce que ça n'a rien à voir?
Not precisely. What I thought normally people would write about a far future of decadent people, and they'd find something bad about it. And I wanted to write novels that had a serious element, but nonetheless, the people themselves were enjoying themselves. They saw nothing wrong with how they lived, and there's not really any bad thing that happens to them. There's obviously a discussion, a moral discussion, and some of that came out of... I was fascinated by the fin de siècle writers, particularly the English fin de siècle writers, or indeed the illustrators, people like Aubrey Beardsley, poets like Ernest Dowson, and all of these... I was inspired by their ideas, including their, if you like, their moral ideas or their ideas about morality. That's how it all came together. I mean, I liked the characters, and as they developed, the central character, Gerrit Carnelian, by falling in love with a woman from Victorian England, you could make a comparison which led very easily to comedy, which I like writing. I've written a fair amount of comedy, but not as much. I'm not usually identified as a writer of comedy. But I have written comic novel, comic thrillers as well, and I do enjoy writing funny books, or what I hope are funny books, and that was how I came to conceive it, really, a number of different elements.
Okay. Y a-t-il une autre question dans la salle? Monsieur, ah ben, oui, allez. Il a levé la main une demi-seconde avant vous.
Bonjour. Vos œuvres ont beaucoup inspiré et fait évoluer quelque part le jeu de rôle. Quelle a été votre participation dans cette activité? Est-ce que vous-même l'avez découverte sur le tard ou dès le début, au moment de la création des premiers jeux?
I have to say I don't play games. I don't play any games. I used to, until I was ruined, I played poker, but I had to give that up because my wife demanded it, because I was a very unlucky poker player and lost a lot of money. But I don't play role-playing games at all. And I think that's probably because I'm satisfied by writing novels. If I have an idea for a character, I put it into a novel rather than into an RPG. I did write a game. I wrote an electronic game, about nearly 20 years ago now, which exists as a book, which came out with Storm. Oh God, I'm sorry, I can't remember Storm's name. Storm Constantine. I wrote the entire game, and it was also supposed to be a movie. It was done with the people who did Wing Commander, which probably a lot of people don't know anymore. But it was a very successful series of games done by a guy called Chris Robinson out of Austin. And when I first got to Texas, when he heard that I was in Texas, he got in touch with me and asked me if I would like to do a game. And I told him that I didn't have a computer at that time. I was still working on a typewriter. And I said I didn't know anything about computers, I didn't know anything about games. I had nothing against them, I had no attitude towards them, but I'm just not a natural game player. I was very bad at sports. And Chris persuaded me to write a new game, which was very elaborate, and I thoroughly enjoyed it because, particularly working with a game company as opposed to a film company, for instance, games have to obey certain rules. I mean, they have to have certain clear rules for you to be able to play them. And so it's much easier to work with game playing creators, game creators, than it is, for instance, to work with Hollywood people, because Hollywood people change the rules every 5 minutes, and you go crazy because they don't seem to realize that if you change something in one place, it alters what happens in the next, whereas of course game people know exactly how things are supposed to work out. And I found it tremendously inspiring. I enjoyed it enormously, but I still don't play. I got too old for games because I realized they gave me a whole bunch of games to play, and at the end of these games, for instance, a gravestone turns up which says R.I.P. Michael Moorcock, because of course I was always losing them, I'm never any good at them, and after a while I began to get a bit depressed because I was dying every time I played a game. And as I said to them, at their age, they were in their 20s, I was in my, at that point, my 60s, 50s, I suppose, 50s or 60s. I said, for you it's just a concept, but for me it's a very close thing that's likely to happen to me any day. So I found it a bit difficult to play that kind of game. But I I enjoy the idea of games a great deal. I just don't play them. And also, I know how much time it takes up. I had a friend who was an author, a very successful author, who began playing role-playing games pretty late in life. I think he must have been about 60 when he started. And he stopped working. I mean, he stopped earning a living. His wife left him. I mean, he wound up working in his garage and having to rent his house to somebody. It was the only way he could make any money. And he just carried on playing games until he died. So that was a lesson to me. But anyway, that's my relationship with games. I still enjoy watching them. I mean, I still enjoy... My wife plays them a lot. I mean, she plays an enormous number of games. But I just don't have any instinct for gaming. Any, really. I'm just not very competitive. So I can't get excited. I mean, I remember I used to play Space Invaders... when that first came out. And after a while, I just wanted to negotiate with the Space Invaders to see, you know, if we couldn't come to some arrangement and stop having to fight one another. And that's it, I'm afraid.
Vous avez compris, vous ne pourrez pas faire une partie de cartes avec Michael Moorcock. On arrive à la fin de cette conférence. Merci à vous d'avoir écouté Michael Moorcock. Merci à Michael Moorcock. Vous allez pouvoir le retrouver en dédicace. Et tout de suite, il y a un hommage à Roland Wagner qui va avoir lieu ici. Merci à tous.
Thank you.